Hey, we're all security experts, right? But you ever have to deal with the problem of privacy? We're finding out that's becoming more and more of a concern in our day and age, and I've got an expert who's going to share with you her insights on how you can address that. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I am your host for today, and I have with me Amy Cardwell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a privilege to have you here. I was going through your background and things like that, and you know, very impressive. United Health Group, Amex, eBay, Expedia, Netscape, Impact Awards, executive women. And I mean, gee whiz, it's like, I am not worthy to have you on the show, but awesome.
You're funny.
But it's true, right? Exactly. So you've done an awful lot, but in your own words, tell us a little about how did you get to where you are right now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm probably the least likely executive you've ever met. I don't have a 4-year college degree. I started working right out of high school and didn't really even finish high school, for those of you others listening who didn't do that. But I am very curious and I love to learn. And from an early age, I've been growing and changing and learning. And that's pretty much what I think all cybersecurity experts have in common. It's a field that's never the same. So even if you graduated with a 40-year degree in cybersecurity, 8 years from then, you're going to have all new information because the playing field will have completely changed.
Absolutely. Another proof of G. Mark's Law. I wrote that over 25 years ago. Half what you know about security will be obsolete in 18 months. All of us are limping along on Windows 10, say goodbye next month, or get ready to write big fat checks to Microsoft. But don't feel it. It's interesting. Some of us have this little concern about our background and you look over our shoulders. I had Danny Jenkins on the show just a little while ago, and he dropped out of school at 15. He's now founder and CEO of a billion-dollar company. He's got his own unicorn. So, we conflate formal education with career success. And to a certain extent, formal education is helpful insofar as it gets you conversant in different languages. For example, I do still recommend an opportunity for people if they want to consider something like a business school, particularly if you came up with a technical background, because it's going to expose you to the language of business. But even then, from a cybersecurity perspective, we have a nuanced perspective of business, and that's on risk and being able to manage risk across our enterprise. And typically, we've tended to think about that as being risk across cybersecurity. But as we want to talk about today, privacy is kind of come up alongside. And now these two different, potentially disjoint sets of the business, we have to start thinking of them more holistically if we're going to be effective in our leadership roles. Would you agree?
I couldn't agree more. Usually the privacy team rolls up to, let's say, the chief legal officer, and the security team rolls up maybe to the CIO or sometimes the COO. And so you're looking at organizations in very different parts of the enterprise. And yet the closer they work together, the better the outcomes are for both teams.
Right. And also you have waste and duplication of effort. If I'm going to try to run two parallel teams, that would seem to be that. Now, what else do you find other than a waste? What type of errors might you see when we start to treat these as two separate silos of excellence, so to speak?
Yeah, so the privacy team is really trying to think about, from a regulatory and governance perspective, what they're doing with people's data. But from a security team, we're also looking at things like, are we deleting data as quickly as we should be? All of the tools that we're trying to use to make sure that we're doing data retention policies and deletion, the privacy team cares a lot about that too. And generally, they have less money than cybersecurity does, right? Cyber tends to get a bigger budget generally. So if you work together, you can actually buy better tools and do the scans once and make sure that you're, as a cyber professional, reducing your attack surface by having as little data as possible. And from the privacy perspective, they're going to be as happy about that as you are.
It's a good point. Yeah, I think cybersecurity, we get more exciting problems and breaches than you get over in privacy. And so as a result, people are like, I'm not going to, sort of the redheaded stepchild there in the organization.
Well, we also have a bigger threat. Like you said, if I say, well, we've got 15 terabytes of data that could be released and I can get that down to 1 terabyte, that's a big risk and a big threat. But if the privacy team says, well, we're going to get hit with a regulatory fine that's either going to be $1 million or $1.1 million, the business is going to be like, yeah, not that interesting.
And it's interesting, though, because you mentioned that. So let me ask this question about risk and looking at where our potential, you know, threat actors are. Typically, there's a whole school of debate out there as to, for example, an organization has a data breach, and particularly if it involves compromise of privacy or PII or things like that. And then regulators are very fast to break out their little green shade and tally it up and say, ah, you owe this huge fine. And thinking like, wait a minute. It's like a guy reports to the police, hey, I just got mugged. How much did they steal from you? They stole all my money, $200. Well, we're going to fine you $50 for getting mugged. It's like, what? What? I'm the victim here. Oh, no, you should have known. But you should have known that there were going to be bad people out on the street. Well, there's always bad people somewhere on the street, but I know exactly where they are. It's not our problem. We need money for the policeman's ball pay up. So that's kind of a humorous way of looking at it. But from a privacy perspective, some of us look over that and they go like, really, do we have to add regulatory entities to our threat actor list as well? Or am I just looking at that incorrectly?
I don't think you're looking at it incorrectly, but I do think there needs to be a penalty for companies who don't take preventive action to protect people's data. So if there weren't any maybe we would all just leave our data unencrypted and we would never delete anything. So, you know, I think they're trying to punish companies who maybe didn't take all the steps that they could have to avoid getting robbed. If you put your wallet, you know, out on the unzipped back pocket of your backpack and it gets robbed, I'm having a little bit less sympathy for you.
Yeah, you're asking about that. Then we have the toss wallet. Is if you grew up in a rough neighborhood, we have a second wallet, which has some expired cards and there are a couple ones. Someone tries to mug you, like, take the money. Rolling, like, whoa, money. And by the time they figure out that it's, yeah, you're already 3 blocks away. I was reading a little bit of something about what they look for when you're going to mug somebody. Not that we want to get into mugging on this one. But if you're going to go out in some weird neighborhood, wear running shoes. Make it look like you can chase them as compared to.
Oh, interesting. It's like the honeypot, isn't it? The safe wallet?
Exactly. And so sometimes we always thought, why don't we do that with PII? Like, we stole all your data. It's like, oh, dear. Yeah, right. It's all fake data. Because we just set it up here, and that was the easiest thing to grab. And then we decoy folks. But what we talked a little bit before about security, privacy, the fact that we may be duplicating our efforts, that cybersecurity today might be getting more budget because of the awareness factor. Privacy does become an important element of running our business responsibly, as well as being enforced on that from the regulatory agencies. But there's actually kind of a new player in town, and that's AI. And artificial intelligence can work really well to help us on the defense side, but it's also democratizing the access to more sophisticated tools and methodologies for those who really don't understand how they work or how to write them, but they can push buttons and they can talk. So what are we seeing then potentially over problems with regard to privacy and the advances of AI because of that disconnect between IT security and privacy?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think about this question from the business perspective. If you're only looking at it as a CISO, you might say, well, we're going to shut down the use of AI across the business. But I think from a business perspective, that's probably not a good idea. You don't want to be a late starter to the AI game. So I'm trying to think about how can I enable the business and enable the experimentation with AI that I know is the right thing for us to do while also protecting information. And there are a couple ways I think about this. The very first thing is data discovery. As with anything CISO related, if you don't know where the data is, you can't protect it. And it's just as likely that it's going to end up in some AI somewhere that you're not aware of. So that's sort of the first thing I think about.
Interesting. So knowing where our data is, do we typically, when we classify information, we look at its business criticality. I think our understanding now, it's pretty well understood that things like PII or anything could be treated like that. Also, payment card data, protected health information. We have whole different categories of things that need to be protected. Do we need to rethink governance at this point based upon the AI threat, or can we just simply try harder what we're already doing and expect to have better results?
Oh my goodness, you couldn't have set me up better for the second half of the AI bit. So I think of it in three ways, three categories, just like you said. For public information, and I list these in most of the AI policies that I've written lately. And I say, if you're writing a job description, changing your marketing material, doing anything that's going to end up public or doesn't have anything company confidential or, of course, PII in it, use any AI you want. Go nuts. Use whatever tool you like. Please go experiment. That's the place for you to play. And then if you have company confidential information, let's say source code, I would want you to only use AI platforms with which we already have an agreement. So if you're using Cursor and you have a relationship with, you know, ChatGPT or Claude or, you know, pick whatever tool you want, great, knock yourself out. But don't use any tools for company confidential information that you don't have an enterprise contract with. But the most interesting one for me is the sensitive information category, because what I want to say is, don't ever put sensitive information into an AI. And the reason I want to say this is because I have found almost no use cases where the sensitive information can't just be de-identified first and then used to train the model. And so if you need to train a model with sensitive information, de-identify it and then train the model to your heart's content. Otherwise, as you know, we have to set up an internal model and make sure that there's no, you know, possibility of that information leaking. And that's just a lot harder than de-identifying, in my opinion.
Yeah. And that was my thought a couple of years ago. And again, I got too many things going around. I need a whole bunch of people saying, what do you want to do next? They go like, hello, sharks. What we have here is a little proxy that you go ahead and you feed all your stuff in there. It automatically identifies sensitive information, puts in the substitute, does all your external stuff. It comes back and said, Joe, it's Tom and not Nancy. It's Sally and this number and that number. And then by having that custom interface there, you're going to be able to identify it. So if somebody's not doing that already, there you go. There's a business idea.
I don't know if there's an auto de-identification tool, but I don't think it's that hard generally to de-identify a bunch of data. I'm pretty sure anybody with a really solid Perl script can take care of it for you.
Yeah, we can vibe code that Perl script too. So we're off and running. Everybody's like, Perl scripts are just like so 2000s. Today, everything's going to be done in Python, right? Okay. Or Rust or something like that. Anyway, so we talk about things, and of course, going forward, we look at AI as being a challenge. But one of the difficulties is even if we started re-architecting everything starting today, we've got a huge amount of legacy data. Usually, it's going to start at, well, it starts out at 100% by definition, then it fades over time. Two ways: either we generate lots of new information, at which point it gets smaller, or as you had alluded to a bit earlier, we delete old information that has no longer any good business use, but could pose a liability. And that's a discussion I have frustration with when I work as a CISO and trying to convince executives who think, well, we might need it someday. I said, it might bite you someday. Think about information like stuff in the back of the refrigerator.
Yeah.
Don't want to see what it looks like a year and a half from now. You probably should get rid of it if you're not going to be utilizing it. So
we should partner up and go on a national campaign about that, because honestly, I've found data, you know, one of the most interesting cybersecurity leaks that I cleaned up after was that there was patient data stuck in the invoice folder of a company. And you're going to say, well, why was there patient data in the invoice folder? You wouldn't think about them. Well, of course, they billed the healthcare companies. And during the bill, they needed to say, these are all the services that we provided to all of these patients.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the invoices. And so they had 15 years of data in the invoices folder. Well, I would challenge you that you probably don't need more than 3 years worth of back invoices.
Yeah, it's really hard to collect on something much older than that. Hey, you forgot to pay this back in high school. You want to be, you know, right. But there's people who, well, they want it. Then PCI DSS, you know, so there's some requirements that you have 7 years requirements. It really comes back.
Yeah.
So the regulators, you've got different forces here. Again, we're a little down a little on the side, but let's talk about it. So we look at data retention. We have a couple forces going on. One, of course, is regulatory. So if we're doing payment card data, PCI, DSS, I'm going to have a requirement there. If I have a federal regulation or some other state regulation that says I have to do this, I'm going to comply with that. But remember, compliance is not necessarily an achievement of excellence. It basically keeps the lawyers happy and it keeps the regulators off your back. That said, beyond that point, the real business criteria is how much value can I extract from information that I am retaining past its mandatory retention date. And if the person who says they want to keep it, if we calmly could push back as a CISO and said, well, hey, boss, please tell me three ways that we have made a profit with information that is older than 3 years, for example, so I know that how valuable this is, you're probably going to get either a hostile pushback or the light bulb will come on and said, well, I guess it's never happened. I said, statistically, it is never going to happen. But what's the possibility of getting served with a discovery notice of saying, hey, an intern that worked with you 5 years ago is now in some sort of legal situation, and we want every email this person ever wrote, every da-da-da-da, and you still got them. And you don't have them indexed correctly, so you're going to spend hundreds of hours digging things out on a case that you don't have a dog in the fight, and you don't have any interest in it. And yet you're liable as compared to being able to go back and say, hey, you know what? Here's our document retention policy. It's been operating for years. We deleted all that 3.5 years ago. Per policy that has been enforced for 5 years, Your Honor, we don't have it. And it's not destruction of evidence. It's just we've been following best practices, at which point the other side has said, yeah, sorry, go fish.
Gee, Mark, I learned that lesson probably 35 years ago when I was at Netscape. Because as you may remember, Netscape was sued by Microsoft and they didn't have a document retention policy, or at least not one that I knew of at the time. I was a pretty low-level employee back then. But literally every email that we ever wrote that said nasty things about Microsoft, all of that was admissible, 100% of it. All of the little chats that we had on our supposedly private chat rooms about what Microsoft was or wasn't doing and all of our internal feelings about Microsoft, all of that was admissible. It's just not a good idea to keep that stuff around. To that end, I have had some success for those folks who are like, no, there's a possibility that one day I'm going to use that data and make $1 billion. I've said, great, let's put it into cold storage, into a deep archive. And if it sits in there for more than 2 years, I'll delete it. Is that okay? And that has actually worked out pretty well because 2 years later, they've totally forgotten about it and are like, what are you talking about? And then I just delete it.
Yeah, it's kind of what in the military is called command by negation. Unless you say otherwise, I am going to do such and such at this time. And if the boss is like, okay with that, because she's got so many other things going on, it's like, oh, yeah, whatever. Or you have a high degree of trust, and then, yeah, I trust you. At which point, you don't have to get permission. Hey, can I delete that 2 year old? Well, wait a minute. Now out comes a pack rat again. So best to say, hey, you know, we agree that within 2 years, if you haven't called for it, it goes away and things like that.
I've now noted that technique as of a future technique for me to use. Thank you very much.
There we go. We're learning from each other. Who knows? You might be seeing the Amy and G-Mark Incorporated helping people out of problems. When we think about getting people out of problems, we're talking about visibility of data, really. And what can we do to improve our visibility of data, particularly if we're talking about legacy? And not all the legacy is necessarily in the same format of what we're working with today. Heaven help you if you're in a file cabinet full of paper folders that you have no visibility into that. But more realistically, how do we get our head around this problem?
There are a number of amazing data discovery tools in the marketplace that have sprouted up in the last 5 years or so. And they work in the same way that like Vanta or Drata do. They have little connectors that connect to all of your different data stores. Mm-hmm. They'll look for Salesforce data. They'll look for data that's in some old, you know, database that you forgot about. So they'll look through your whole network and find sources of data so that, you know, now you know where they sit and you can actually see whether or not they're being touched and try to figure out how to close down as many of those databases as possible. But if nothing else, at least you can see where they are. Again, think about GDPR and a customer's right to be forgotten. If you don't even know where their data is stored, how are you going to comply with that?
Unless we answer, we forgot where we stored it. Does that mean it's a right to be forgotten?
I don't think that's going to hold up, but you can give it a shot.
You know, for people in the U.S., they think a right to be forgotten, that means all that pictures of the stupid stuff I did in college, I can delete it when I'm applying for jobs. No, the right to be forgotten means, for example, I do business with a company. At the end of the transaction, I buy something. They sell it to me. They got my client data. And I say, you know what? I'm not going to do business with you anymore. So they say, we have complied with GDPR with your right to be forgotten. Next month, I read about this company having a data breach. I'm not too worried about it because if they are, in fact, following what they said they were doing, my data has already been deleted and I'm off the hook. And so it's popcorn time. We can watch, see what happens, but we're not in that game.
Well, but also I think you and I, having seen and worked with very large enterprises, I'll use United Health Group as an example. They acquire two new companies a month, every month. So CISOs used to think about perimeters. Perimeters don't mean anything when you keep throwing two new companies in every month, right?
Mm-hmm.
But my data might be at the podiatry office that we just bought. My data might be at the dentist office that we just bought. And so now that it's owned by United Health Group, they're still responsible for removing the bits of data that belong to me. Healthcare is a little bit different because, as you said, there are some regulatory requirements about storing patient data. But you can think about that for any company that might do a lot of acquisitions.
Yeah, that's a good point. And things age out over time, although, if someone, I don't know how much of a case they would have if someone said, hey, these are my medical records from 35 years ago. I don't want them disclosed. Well, so what? Who cares? But who knows? I'm not an expert, and most of us probably won't have to worry about that. But let's kind of get out of the past and back into the future again. So, we talked about, but what about AI? And so what we found out is that we look back in our history. So, you talk about Netscape, and that's where we're first starting to go ahead and communicate as compared to, hey, everything is local, standalone. And then we had like, oh, wow, Novell Network. I can actually connect a couple computers together and just run this cable around here and clamp a little vampire taps on this Ethernet cable. But what comes now is that with AI, if we think of the errors we might have made in going out to the cloud, the cloud governance problems, things that we hear about S3 buckets being unprotected, a major compromise has taken place because the cloud hosting organizations are following the directions of the client. The client did not enforce or choose to enforce or even might not have been aware of best practices. And so, yeah, there it is. It's out there. So we've had a lot of problems in the past. How do we avoid those problems going forward with the way we roll out AI? And can we directly apply those lessons learned, or are we in a terra incognita and we got to figure it out ourselves?
Well, I love that you drew the parallel between, moving to the cloud early and what's happening with AI. And I draw those parallels all the time because I say, remember the companies who were afraid to go into the cloud and instead they built their own private cloud and then they tried to do a hybrid cloud and then they tried to do a cloud agnostic cloud. And so they were sort of moving slowly because of their fear. And there were other companies who were like, I'm leaving the data center behind. I'm going headfirst into the cloud. The companies that did that went headfirst into the cloud actually fared better. They spent less money and a lot less effort. And their data got sort of cloud native faster. Their data and applications got cloud native faster. And that's why earlier I said, I really want everybody in the company to be playing with AI. I really want to encourage people to use it. Because if you end up being the last company on the block who has an AI literate workforce, it's not going to be very good for your business. That said, up until recently, that was pretty dangerous because you're expecting Bob in accounting or Joe, the customer service rep, to do the right thing by your policy. But there are some new data applications out there. I think one was actually just bought by SentinelOne that looks at all of the things that people type into AI prompts and automatically redacts sensitive information. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any of those in action?
I've heard of it. I haven't actually played with it, but...
So good. I learned about this from my board role, actually. I watched it in action and I was shocked, just shocked. Literally, company sensitive information was redacted. PII was redacted. It was really impressive.
Well, I like the fact you said shocked, because here's the next business idea. We're going to connect a cable from the PC to the user seat so that when they put in the information in the AI, they get a voltage through them. And you're going to be sitting there and you're, and around. After a while, the noise should die down as people figure out what they should be doing.
Pavlov is applauding you right now.
As long as we don't do a Stanley Milgram. In any case, for those who are not familiar with it, go look it up. So many
or
inside
don't.
Jokes. Or don't. Yeah, we have so many inside jokes on this one. So as we take the lessons learned from cloud and we apply to AI, we realize that going fast... First, we're concerned with AI. Now we think maybe, take the foot off the brakes a little bit. We could go, it doesn't look as bad. But at the same time, it's important to understand what guardrails have to be in there. I think we've articulated some of them. First of all, if you are not paying for the product, you are the product. And so write that giant $20 a month check if you're doing anything at home. It's worth it. Trust me. Okay. You spend less, a lot more money on coffee through your budget for the month. And then secondly, for your organization, get an enterprise license. We've been back and forth with my clients doing that. And we've settled out on a couple different AI models. And we said, basically, here's what you can use because we're paying for it. Here's what you cannot use, which is the rest of the universe. But if you're using your own personal stuff, that's fine. That's you. Just be aware of the fact that you don't get those protections. But short of being able to put either the de-anonymizers, you know, or anonymizer in, de-anonymizer going back out, or the transition and things like that from going from something known to something abstract, but it'll still function, those are guidelines that I'm offering to organizations right now. What else are you offering in terms of things that you put into your AI policies?
Those are all the things that I have in my policies, but I do supplement that with AI literacy programs. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that we have phishing education programs, and many companies do those monthly or quarterly, for most of my clients, we're doing AI literacy programs as well, both to offer ideas on how best to use AI, because again, I want AI literacy in the company as quickly as possible. And of course, also to say, here's what you should do, here's what you can do, and here's what you cannot do. That, I think, is also protective in a court of law. So, you know, if somebody does make a mistake and you get busted for it, it's not that hard to say, yes, but that person has taken four different AI trainings that contained these pieces of information. So I think it's both healthy and also protective.
And even want to add a little bit of belt and suspenders to the protection after you say, hey, here is your AI policy. Okay, fine. I agree. I'll think of it. Great. Here's a quiz. What?
Right.
Here's a quiz. What? It's a written. Well, it's open book. All right. Yeah, do it. Grade it. Guess what? Okay, good. You got 100 into your HR folder. Next year, quiz. Now, 4 years later, something blows up. And of course, the lawyers on the other side are not really interested in necessarily getting the truth. They just want to cash out. But then you've got some pretty good resistance. Say, well, it's not the company's fault. It's this person. Yeah, but you're responsible. Well, we have a policy. Yeah, but he didn't know the policy. Well, actually, he signed the policy, but he didn't understand it. Well, he took a quiz and he got 100. Yeah, that was, but then he took it again. And then he took it again. Then he took it again. What you're doing is you're building up enough that it's going to say, you know, there might be an easier way to make money than go after that.
That's exactly
right. And so
right.
Nothing's perfect, because ultimately, if you're up against the other side whose lawyer plays golf with the judge, you know, all things are up in the air. And they used to say, if you think going to court with the best lawyer is expensive, try going to court with the second best lawyer. So as we look at these things going forward, and, you know, we've talked about AI, AI governance, and some insights for that. And I think those are excellent ones that you offered. So thank you very much for those. What we look then is that, as we said, don't use customer identifiable data to train your AI models. If you're going to use a private model, a Llama base, there's plenty of open source models that are coming down. And we're getting to the point where I've even read some people have got some stuff that'll work on a Galaxy phone, a LLM that'll do something. But also, I think for those of us dealing with AI, there's just something yesterday in Wall Street Journal. Of course, it's not going to be yesterday when people watch your show, so you have to go look it up. But they had five different deepfakes. And you had to listen to the deepfakes and say which one are lives and which ones are bad. And then, you know, what was your score? And I got all five of them right. And it was interesting.
I'm impressed, by the way. That's impressive.
I was too. I was kind of surprised. But at the same time, I've got this AI detector that definitely works in terms of written stuff. I had worked with one guy who used to send back one-word answers on his email. And then all of a sudden, out of the middle of nowhere, well, whereas it's important to consider all the elements that involve, like, where.
And they're bulleted. All the emails are bulleted with little sections.
The M space. Yes, the M space. This tells. So if I do use AI, and I write my episodes myself, but I will go ahead and use AI for some research to go get stuff. But I have found out it hallucinates, and it does it a lot. I was looking at one particular talk I'm doing for a bank next month, looking at financial regulations, and it's a European bank. And they say, well, what things are they complied with? When they come up with NYDFS, it's like, no. I need something that operates over there. So they gave me some documents I was not familiar with. And I said, okay, well, give me chapter and verse. So this is chapter section 3. This is section 4. And I downloaded the documents, did a thing, and it was not those sections. So I had to go back.
You
and
even
say,
asked it for the reference, and the references were fake.
And I ran the reference. Well, the document was there.
Right.
But that, misquoted but the section.
Yeah.
So I had to use those magic words, think harder. and then with Think Harder, it cranked away, and then it came back with the correct link. But what I caution people is a couple of things. One is, don't outsource your research. Consider it to be a very eager but very junior assistant, somebody who is going to try hard, but is, to be polite, a low potential high achiever, somebody who works really hard to get mediocre results. And you know, we might have hired people like that. But in any case, in the AI perspective, it's trust but verify, and the emphasis on verify, because these models, if you understand how they work, they're basically predictive, where they're just going to one token after the next token after the next token. Typically, when we're doing language models, tokens are words, and we just pick the most common word that's likely to come so it sounds sense. So I say peanut, you go peanut butter and jelly, peanut butter and jelly sandwich. But if I restart the sequence, give me the next thing, peanut, peanut allergies, peanut, and then what comes, oh, peanut allergies may be a problem for young children or for people on airplanes. And then if you keep on going and keep going, peanut, the squirrel was killed by the New York Department of Agriculture, you know, whatever. And then after a while, you get to the things where you go, wow, it's creative. It came up with such an amazing idea. You know what? These things aren't creative. It just picked
glued a whole bunch of words together.
It glued them together that based on low probabilities, that's all it was left. And it just happened to make sense. It's like a chess player would throw away all the nearly infinite moves that you could make for a handful that do make sense. But we find out that this will do things that don't always make sense. And what it cannot do, what I've not yet seen an AI model do, come back and say, I don't know. I would love for it to come back and say, I don't know.
That's a great question.
because it's like 0.0001. Hey, I've got a piece of data there. Let me go fetch it and come up, and I'm going to serve it with the same confidence level that I would serve something that is almost obvious. So that's the danger there, is you'll always get an answer back and things like that. So you mentioned about AI literacy. And so it's important that we communicate not just to our technical leadership, but to business leadership across functions, HR, for example, looking at manufacturing or sales or whatever. These folks have to get enough about AI that they can then understand that it's not a magic bullet. It has great capabilities, but built within those capabilities are the seeds of its own failures, which is it will forcing to give you an answer. And that forcing function is not based upon probabilities. It's based upon a requirement that you get some answer back. We may change from that level. So what education do you recommend both for CISOs? Of course, we're going to start out because do we need to be the agent of change? Should that come from HR? Should that come from IT? Where should that agent of change come from in terms of making AI literacy an important element of an organization's culture?
Well, remember when we started this conversation, we said that CISOs have a big hammer, right? So we have the ability to influence the whole organization better than almost any other part of the organization. So if we say, look, we're already doing phishing training and we're going to add AI literacy training to that training, most people are going to be like, is it going to cost me anymore? And be like, well, it's a little bit more, but not very much. So they'll be like, great, okay, make it happen. Because you already have a channel for this. Whereas if the AI czar of your company, if you even have one, because in many companies, the AI oversight is very sort of disaggregated, that's, you're never going to get AI literacy in the company. So I don't pay a lot of attention to, does that fall under my job title? I pay a lot of attention to, is this a thing that I'm suitably placed to help the business make progress on?
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say that AI training necessarily falls under the CISO, but I would say if you have the ability to be the driver of it, you should make that happen.
That's a very good point. And I think, although I want to work in an organization where I get to hold a hammer instead of having it held over my head. But so that'll help out. Other thoughts that you have, ultimately, when do we know that we've got AI risk under control? Is it ever under control, or
any risks under control ever?
Let me refine that term. AI risk to an acceptable level, where we all accept a certain level of risk.
Yeah. With the tools that I see coming out now, with the redaction of data that people put into AI, I'm starting to believe that that risk can get a little bit easier, at least from the distributed problem of having all of your employees have access to AI. You know, initially, I think what we did was say, we're just going to shut down the connection between any work computer and any AI. But as we've already discussed, we also don't want to shut down people's ability to use a tool that everybody else in the world is using.
Right.
So that connection of tools that's finally starting to catch up reduces that risk. For me, the next big risk is people who mean well, but make big mistakes, like dumping a whole PII database into an AI because they're trying to draw conclusions from it without doing good de-identification. So I think that's where a lot of my focus is right now is how do I create a really lightweight governance board and make sure that folks know when they should come to that governance board for assistance?
Wow. I think that's really good insight. So other thoughts you might have in terms of words of wisdom for CISOs or people who are aspiring to become CISOs?
I come from a technical background like many CISOs, and it's taken me a very long time in my career to realize that the softer skills are just as important, if not potentially more important, than the technology skills. And so the lesson that I always try to impart is relationships across the enterprise matter. And you should really start making sure that you're investing as much time on making solid relationships across the leadership team early before you need them. Mm-hmm. Because when you do need them, you'll be really glad you did that.
That's really good insight. Well, any last thoughts before we wrap up here?
This has been a great conversation. I love how aligned we are on so many of these thoughts.
And I have enjoyed this incredibly well. So for our watchers or listeners out there, this has been Amy Cardwell, and we've been talking a lot about AI governance, looking into different ways of getting our hands around privacy as it compares to security. And there's sort of an intersection of all three of those, and it's emerging. We're going to see how things go, and it's going to change over time. If you follow us on CISO Tradecraft on LinkedIn, great. If not, you're missing out, because we do more than just podcasts. We also have a good steady stream of posts that are high information, low noise, good signal to noise ratio, a Substack newsletter, as well as other programs. For example, of course, this is going to air after I record this, but I'm hopping on a plane this afternoon to fly to London. I'm teaching a half-day course on cybersecurity leadership for 44Con. Under the CISO Tradecraft label. Hopefully that'll work out well, and we're going to bring this back to the U.S., and we're going to make some more training available for people out there so you can get better at your CISO Tradecraft. So thank you very much for being part of our show. Amy, thank you, as always, for what your contributions are to the community and to the industry, as well as being part of CISO Tradecraft. And for listeners out there, this is your host, G. Mark Hardy. And until next time, stay safe out there.